want to take a couple of minutes before my lesson to tell you about something that I was impressed with on the trip that I just made to Peru. One of the places that we visited was an orphanage that you have all heard something about. But it's like so many other things, until you're there and until you personally see it, then you're not as impressed as you probably should be. So we had the opportunity to meet with the fellow who began this orphanage there in Peru, and he told us his story. And his story really touched my heart, and I don't know if you've heard it or not. I had never heard the story, and so I thought I would take a moment and share that with you. And I don't know the time frame, but some years back, he and his wife had a son, if I remember correctly, was 5 years old. And they do have medical insurance that is provided, or medical attention that's provided by the state. But sometimes that looks better on paper than it does in reality. And so in reality, if you had a really special need, if you do not have money, then you won't very likely be treated for that special need. And their son got sick, and fortunately they did have money. He and his wife had some money, and so they took their son to the hospital. He was treated, but unfortunately he died. And as he and his wife left the hospital that day that their son died, they came outside the property of the hospital, and there were two little boys that had been abandoned because they needed medical attention, and their parents didn't have any means to get that medical attention for them. And so he and his wife discussed it and decided that they knew what they were going to do with the rest of their life. And they went out and sold his business and sold everything that they had. And they began to take street children, take them in and take care of them, just on their own. And it's kind of an interesting scenario there in Peru. Evidently, if there's a piece of property that is unclaimed and you squat on it for 2 days and nobody protests, then it's yours. And so they squatted on a piece of ground. And they began to build some facilities there with what funds they had and what funds others donated. And that has now grown to the point that they have 650 children. They don't turn anybody away. Children come to the gates of their facility and ask if they can stay there, and they allow them to come in. And they have a number of special needs children, and they don't turn anybody away, and they do everything that they can for all of them. The story gets even more interesting because they refuse to take any funds from the government there. Because if the government gives you funds, then just like any other government, they want to control it. And that means things that they didn't, you know, that they wanted to avoid for those children that they're rearing. And so now they have about 650 children. That changes every day. They found two children in the dump just before we came and took those children in. And they're feeding and housing and clothing and providing everything that they can for those 650 children. They have 14 people on the staff that are paid either part or whole time, which none of it is very much at all. And the interesting part was, you would think that there would be a lot of chaos with 650 children and 14 people on the staff. But it was not at all the case. In fact, the big ones take care of the little ones. And that's how it operates. They're so happy to be off the street. They're so happy to have a place that has some security and where people care about them, that you just see the big ones, whenever a little one starts crying, there's an older child, may not be much older, maybe 2 or 3 years older, that goes over and picks them up and starts holding them and consoling them and trying to find out what's wrong. And so it's really a neat thing. When I moved here almost 8 years ago, on this wall right here, you had a chart. You remember? How many of you remember that chart? And I can't remember how much money it was that you were raising, but you were more than halfway there when I moved here. And you met that goal. It was something like $125,000 that you donated to that orphanage. And with that money, among other things, they were able to build a secure wall around the property that they have. They exist on donations. And it's really kind of interesting where those donations come from sometimes. Just not long before we were there, an 18-wheeler loaded with onions overturned and spilled all the onions out. And the authorities called this orphanage and told them that there was, a road full of onions there if they had anything they could do with them. And so they loaded up a bunch of the kids, took them out there, and they picked all the onions up and sold them and put a new roof on one of the buildings that needed a roof on it. So they're existing hand to mouth. And while these people that started this are not members of the Church of Christ, I will say they are people of great faith. And I really respect and appreciate that work there. And so what you have done and what you continue to do for that work there, and then also probably you'll hear some more about the church that is beginning in that area, then that's a really, really good work. And so I commend you for that work that you're doing. And I'm proud to be a part of a congregation that is helping, seriously helping, so many different works like that around the world. I heard about a college recruiter who interviewed a high school basketball star, and the recruiter said, "I hear you're a pretty good player." The player said, "I'm the best there is. I averaged 45 points a game. I was the best rebounder in my high school. I led our team to 3 undefeated seasons and 3 state championships." The recruiter said, "That's incredible. Tell me, do you have any weaknesses?" He ducked his head and he said, "Well, just one. I do have a tendency to exaggerate a little." The truth is, we all have weaknesses, don't we? That may be difficult, and it is a difficult thing for some of us to admit. For example, I've heard that 90% of men rank themselves above average in athletic ability. So, boys and girls, when your mom and or in particular your dad tells you how great an athlete he was, you might take it with a grain of salt. Whether we want to admit it or not, we all have weaknesses. Some of our weaknesses are physical, some are mental, some are moral. Some of these weaknesses have to do with our work. Some of them have to do with our family life, some with our relationship with Christ. Some of us, for example, have short tempers. Others of us lack diplomacy. Some of us are too proud. Some of us don't have very much backbone to stand up for what's right. We've all got weaknesses that we struggle with. And one of the truths that we have to come to grips with is that the church is full of weak Christians. We all have weaknesses. Here's a brother who misses the assembly for reasons that we know that are not right. Here's another brother that doesn't give as he ought to because there's so many things that he wants to buy to allow him to enjoy life. Here's a sister who struggles with gossip or with drinking. Here's a brother who doesn't understand this particular Bible doctrine the same way that we do. The church is, in fact, filled with weak Christians. And just when you get to the point that you start admiring this really, really strong Christian, and you really look up to him and you put him on a pedestal, then guess what? When you get to know him, you find out he too has weaknesses. He lets you down. You find out that he struggles with problems just like you do. So what are we going to do about those in the church who are weak? What should be our relationship to the weak members of the body? Well, we just talked about the starting place. We begin with the recognition that all of us are weak in different areas. And we remind ourselves that the Lord said, "With what judgment you judge, you shall be judged." And that's not a bad place to start, is it? And it's probably not a bad place to end, but I'm going to go a little bit further. Some members of the body are rightly called strong and some are called weak. And that's legitimate terminology because the Bible uses it. But there are no persons in the body who's not weak. And weak and strong are relative terms. They're never used in the New Testament to say that there is some Christian who's weak all the way through, or that there are other Christians who are strong all the way through. Rather, we're all weak and strong in certain areas of living. And the word strong generally means that we brought our behavior in line with that of Jesus Christ. And the word weak generally means that we've not yet attained that goal. And I use the word generally in there because that's not the way that Romans 14 uses those terms. And once a year, I try to preach a sermon from Romans 14. I haven't done it, so time's closing in on me. So sometime, very likely between now and the end of the year, we'll have a lesson on Romans 14 because I really believe that that's a key to the unity in the church, to handling how we handle problems in the church. And in that context, the terms weak and strong are not used as we normally expect them to be used. But it's important to note, and I want to make note for sure, that I'm not saying that all sin can be categorized as, quote, weakness. There is deliberate, willful, habitual sin that's not a matter of weakness. It's a matter of rebellion. It's a matter that can only be addressed properly, biblically, by calling it exactly what it is, and that's sin. And it must be dealt with that way and not dealt with as a weakness. So not every sin can be dealt with in terms of calling it and dealing with it as a weakness. But we all recognize that as we strive to live the Christian life, there are some areas where it's more difficult for us to be the kind of person that we want to be and that we know that God wants us to be. I may be strong in moral purity, but weak in controlling my tongue. I may be strong in faithful attendance, but weak in giving as I ought to. And time again, we've experienced moments where the spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak, have we not? Have we not all struggled with those kind of things in our life? And hopefully, by God's grace, as I grow and as I mature as a Christian, I become stronger in more and more areas and am able to overcome the weaknesses in my life with God's help. But there are no strong Christians who don't have some weaknesses. We all have areas of weakness. And even the very strong, the strongest among us, are still far below the standard that Christ set for us. We see it over and over again in the biblical records, and we think of the men that we consider the heroes of faith, and we could stop and have an entire lesson. I can mention Noah. Did Noah have any weaknesses? Yeah, you remember after the flood, he planted a vineyard and got drunk, and the result was that one of his sons and his descendants had an extremely difficult life from that point on because of it. Remember Abraham, the father of the faithful. Did he have any weaknesses? Well, if you were his wife, you might could tell him a thing or two, couldn't you? About when he claimed that she's my sister and not my wife and let another man take her. How about David? Did he have any weaknesses? He was a murderer, wasn't he? He was an adulterer, wasn't he? How about Elijah? After his encounter on Mount Carmel with the 450 Baal prophets, and Jezebel sent word to him, may God do so and more unto me if by this time tomorrow you're not just like those Baal prophets. And he got scared, he got discouraged, and he ran. And how about Paul? Did he have any weaknesses? How about Peter? Did he have any weaknesses? Yeah. Even the strongest. We see it in strong disciples all around us, strong men and women who have trouble maybe with a critical spirit, or maybe seeking preeminence in some area, or arrogance, or some other area of struggle. Let's begin with the confession that we're all mutually weak, and we all need the prayers and encouragement of one another. And we can say with David in Psalm 6, verse 2, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I'm weak." Some of us are weaker than others, obviously, but none of us are without weakness. So with that thought in mind, what should our relationship be with those who are weak? And I think maybe to best answer that question, we should begin by looking at how God feels about those who are weak. The tendency, by the way, on the part of those who are strong toward those who are weak, in Romans chapter 14, verse 3 and verse 10, is to think lightly of them, or to look down on them. And if we look around ourselves, we see that perhaps even in ourselves. When we see somebody that's struggling with something that we consider to be somewhat maybe even disgusting, what do we think about them? We look down on such people. We think lightly of them. We don't want to spend our time with them. But how does God feel about the weak? In Romans chapter 5, verse 6, it assures us that God loves the weak. Paul said, "For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly." And so when did Christ die for us? It was while we were without strength, while we were weak. How does God view weakness? Moral and spiritual weakness, I mean. Words like weak and weakness occur about 87 times in the New Testament. And in all those passages, there's not one word of condemnation or one single incident that talks about weakness. Did you know that? In all those passages, that's not something, weakness is not something that's extolled, but neither is it condemned. Perhaps the best word to use for it, and I'm on my own right here, but God tolerates weakness. He strives to free us from weakness and bring us to maturity, but he doesn't view weakness as intolerable. In 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, he says, "These things are written that you do not sin," or that you sin not. But if you sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. And so the ideal is that we don't sin, but none of us are ideal, are we? And so, thankfully, God has made provision for that. A refusal to move toward maturity is rebellion. It's rebellion against God. Weakness doesn't mean that we are impenitent, or it doesn't mean that we become callous about what it is that we struggle with. It means being without strength. And if God's against the weak, then he's against all of us. In Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1 through 4, Isaiah prophesied about somebody whom God holds very, very dear to his heart. One who has his total, wholehearted approval, and that person is Jesus Christ. This passage is quoted in Matthew chapter 12. The prophet Isaiah says regarding Jesus, in fact, Chris read this passage this morning in the Bible class, "A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench." Matthew chapter 12, verse 20. Now, I have to tell you, that passage didn't mean much to me. I always read that and never could. It took me a long time to figure out what he was saying about talking about Jesus. And it was talking about his tenderness, his compassion. And it says that he doesn't break a bruised reed, and he doesn't quench smoking flax. And so as you look at those two things, he drew them both together, what is it that they have in common? There's something that a bruised reed has in common with smoking flax. Well, you have to know what the two things are. And let's see if we can figure it out together. A reed in that day in marshy areas grew up to 10 or 15 feet tall, and they weren't flimsy. They were relatively strong. Not as strong, and I want to say like bamboo, but they're not as strong as bamboo, because bamboo, when it's dried, is incredibly strong. But it's stronger than what we normally think of as the little green reeds that we see growing in marshy areas. It was something that was stronger than that, and it was very common. It was used for a number of different things, and one of the things that it was used for, when you found one that had some age on it and some size on it, they would cut it off and let it dry and use it as a measuring stick or even as a walking stick. But if a reed happened to be bruised when it was green, then it became worthless. Why? Because it was weak. And so you would normally just break it up and throw it away. And how does Jesus view bruised reeds? Weak people. Isaiah says he doesn't break them. Knowing full well that they're fragile, he loves them. And he spends time with them. And he identifies with their weakness, and he challenges them to higher things, but he doesn't break them. He's compassionate. And what about the smoking flax? Well, in those days, many of you have seen at least replicas of the lamps that they used for light in homes of those days. They were filled with olive oil, normally, and they had something put in as a wick. They made wicks that you could buy, but you could use almost anything that would burn slowly as a wick. And you put it down into that oil and you lit it, and then everything was fine and it would burn with a little flame until the oil got low. And it operated very much like a candle does today whenever it gets low. What starts happening? You look over and your candle's low and all of a sudden it's putting out all this really black smoke, right? And you have this wick that's burning and it's putting out all the smoke, but the oil's almost gone. And the natural thing for a person to do when he sees that is to reach over with his two fingers and put it out and just quickly quench it. So Jesus doesn't do that. Now, what do those two things have in common? They show weakness, don't they? They show something that's about to be gone, something that's about to go out. What did Jesus do with this smoking wick? Well, the implication is that instead of reaching over and doing what was natural and just snuffing it out, then he would go over and very slowly, so as not to put that wick out, he would begin to refill that little, what's the word for it, that little candle holder, that little oil holder, and replenish the supply of oil. And he leans over, and certainly he's going to be irritated by this smoke that is putting out, but he has to take his time so as not to put it out and then blow that wick back into flame again. God tolerates weakness. He doesn't commend it, but neither does he condemn it. And he is kind. And he is sensitive toward weakness. God tries to bring weakness to strength. That's his goal for all of us. But he loves us even while we're weak. And he doesn't give up on us because we're weak. Now, we talked this morning about there can reach a point in our lives if we persist in rebellion against God where the Bible says God will give you over to certain things. But not because of weakness. God doesn't give up on you because of weakness. He doesn't us out, does he? You know, one of the scriptures that I find really challenging, that Paul says, to the strong I become as one who's strong, and to the weak I become as one who's weak. And I've tried to think, what must that look like in practicality? How did he become weak to as someone who was weak when he was around people who were weak? Well, he gives an illustration. I'm not going to go into the whole detail of it, but he gives the illustration when he writes to the Corinthians, doesn't he? He talks about there were some people who could eat meat that had been offered to idols and other Christians whose conscience wouldn't allow them to. And he said, whenever I'm around someone who says, I can't eat that, he says, I push it back. I don't even argue with them. I know that there's only one God, and I know that an idol is nothing. But if it bothers them, then I don't have to eat that meat. And so to the weak, I become as weak. He's not saying that I sin because I'm around people that sin, but that there are people whose conscience bothers them about certain things. And I'm not going to try to make them live by my conscience. He said, if you have conviction about something, keep it between yourself and God. You don't have to force your conscience or your opinions on other people. God sent Jesus Christ to this earth to show us how he wants us to live. And he says, follow his example. Let the mind that he has, the attitude that he has, be your attitude. And so we try to keep from failing. But how many times do you find yourself in a situation like Paul said in Romans chapter 7, verse 24, after he said, I know what's right and I try to do it and I know what's wrong and I keep doing the wrong thing and I'm not able to do the right thing. Oh, wretched man that I am, who'll rescue me from this body of death? We struggle, and I sympathize and empathize with that struggle. And just when we would expect God to turn his back on us and walk away, he stretches out his hand and he says, let me help you get up. Let's go again. That's what grace is all about. Jesus is committed to the weak. He went to the cross for us who are weak. He's worked with bruised reeds and smoking wicks from the very beginning. Think about the apostles that he chose. He chose them. As I look at these men, I'm not sure who I would personally like if I were in that crowd. I don't think I would like Peter. He was always had to be first, and he always had to be the show off. He had to win, didn't he? I don't like people like that too much, do you? I don't like the ones that are just quick and impetuous and think that they have to win and they're braggarts. But then on the other hand, I see John. And John, he was a teacher's pet. And he wanted to be. And he called himself that, the one whom Jesus loved. And he was, whenever Jesus sat down, he was quick to be right there and sit down beside him. Then he'd lay his head over on his chest. I don't know if I'd be real close to John either. You know, I don't know. I guess I'd be probably the odd man out here. They were all so immature. They just couldn't understand. Jesus kept talking about spiritual kingdom. They kept thinking of physical kingdom. He kept talking about service and humility, and they kept arguing about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And he picked them. And he knew their personalities. He knew that they were going to forsake him when the time came. He knew that Peter was going to deny him. I know that he knew that because he told Peter he was going to. And he didn't just learn it that day. He knew it from the beginning. And yet he still picked those men. And I think, boy, that gives me some hope. I know that Jesus had to be disappointed in those disciples many times. How many times did he say, oh, ye of little faith? And when he looked at Peter after that third denial, I don't know what was in those eyes. I don't know what was in that look, but there had to be some sadness, didn't there? There had to be some disappointment, even though he knew and he had told Peter it was going to happen. But Jesus was patient and he was understanding, and even though that reed was bruised, he didn't break it, did he? Whenever he came forth from the grave and he sent word to his disciples, go tell my disciples and Peter. He picked him out and Peter that I'll meet him in Galilee. Because he knew Peter. And he knew that if he said, Jesus said for all of his disciples, all of his followers to come and meet him in Galilee, he probably knew that Peter wouldn't have come because Peter didn't deserve to be called a disciple anymore in his own mind. I think that's probably true. And so he didn't reach over and snuff out that smoldering wick. Even though it was about to go out, it was flickering and about to die. Then he reinforced it, didn't he? You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in this world. I hate. I don't know what there is that keeps attracting me. I'm like a fly to the flame to watch the news. I don't know why, you know? Because I turn it on knowing that I'm going to get upset. But yet I turn it on anyway. And all of this stuff that's going on in the world, I thank God for you, my family. I thank God that I'm part of a family that's been born again, that has our future secure. That God has promised us that it's going to end well. And in fact, we're going to live happily ever after. I like that, don't you? I mean, I take more comfort in that now than I ever have in my life before. And I hope that you do too. There's a Peanuts cartoon. That's one of my favorite philosophies. Lucy is writing, and she's spelling out loud as she's writing, and she writes and spells D-E-E-R. And Charlie Brown interrupts her, and he says, that should be D-E-A-R. In the salutation of a letter, the proper word and the spelling of that word is D-E-A-R. And Lucy looks at him, and she goes back to writing, speaking as she writes, deer are beautiful animals found in most parts of the world. And Charlie Brown is embarrassed. And he says, I'm sorry, Lucy, I didn't realize you were writing about the animals, deer. I'm sorry, I apologize. And Lucy said, well, I should hope so. It seems to me that a lot of the problems in the world are caused by people who criticize others before they know what we're talking about. And she glares at him while he slumps and walks off. And she again looks down at the paper that she's written. She crumples up the page, throws it away, and starts writing again. Dear Julia, the truth is, those of us who are weak in certain areas, all of us are generally afraid to share our weaknesses with other Christians, aren't we? It's just a hard thing to do. And yet, James tells us to do that very thing, doesn't he? You know it's true. There are temptations that we struggle with, problems that we're having that we're afraid to talk about with anybody else because we don't think anybody else would understand. And besides that, we're taking a risk if we confess our weaknesses to one another. And we don't want to be criticized. We don't want anybody to look down on us, think less of us. So we keep it inside. We put a mask on that says, I've got it all together. I've solved all my problems. Everything's fine. And the result is that other Christians around us don't feel comfortable about sharing their weaknesses with us either. A man comes to Christ out of a really horrible moral background. His life has been filled with a lot of trash. And he has renounced that in the name of Jesus. But as much as he hates it, some of it still clings to him. His strong fellow disciples have their lives well in line with what Jesus wants, and at least it appears that way. And he wants to be like them. He wants to be mature and blameless in his conduct. So he struggles along, and with great perseverance, he shows some progress. And as he does, his strong brothers and sisters commend him. But he also falls on his face fairly often. The strong Christians who know that, he can tell they're embarrassed by him. And the strong, who appear to have no failings, make it hard for him to confess his mistakes. And he has no desire soon to share those mistakes with him. Confession becomes an excruciatingly painful thing. And he's too ashamed now to openly confess his sin. He's too afraid that he's going to be discovered when he doesn't by those strong around him who might think he's a hypocrite. And so what happens is he quits coming to the assemblies. And when the strong come to restore him, he makes up lots of excuses. But he's still ashamed to confess the struggles and the problems that he has because he fears how the strong will react. James 5:16, therefore confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. What exactly are we as Christians doing with those who are weak, who haven't come yet as far as they should? I know that we'd rather all of our brothers and sisters have no weaknesses, but that's not how it is. And so would others prefer that we have no weaknesses. But that's not how it is. What we wish for and what the actual state of affairs are two different things. Would you rather the weak kept their pain and their anguish in? Or that they go to someone stronger and find someone who is receptive? Someone who would help them pray with them, study with them, hold them as they struggle with their sin. Those who are stronger have a responsibility to those who are weak. God didn't make us strong so we could strut around. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul's talking about different gifts that they had in the church, but he said, but the manifestations of the Spirit are given to each one for the profit of all. God strengthens people so that we can support those who are weak. And there are areas where you're strong, and I'm weak. And there are areas where perhaps I'm strong and you're weak. And I can turn to you and you can turn to me for help. In Romans 15, 1 and 2, we then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples or the weaknesses of the weak. Not to please ourselves, let us each please his neighbor for his good, leading to edification or building up. 1 Thessalonians 5:14, now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all. 1 Corinthians 9:22, to the weak I became as weak that I might win the weak. I become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. Galatians 6:1, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. And the word trespass, a man's taken, overtaken in a trespass, it means an open offense. It's not a mistake. It is that he blew it big time. It's not just a tiny slip. He's talking about someone who's been caught red-handed in a deliberate violation of God's law. That same word is used in Romans chapter 5 and 1 Timothy chapter 2 to refer to Adam and Eve's sin. That wasn't a slip. It was a rebellious act, deliberate and willful. But if that sin is accompanied by a sense of sorrow and penitence, God tells us that we're to help the weak, even those who have deliberately sinned against God. We're to restore the weak. The word restore is often used of mending nets and setting bones, something that has been really messed up. I've told you before that when I was a kid, my dad was a commercial fisherman. At one time, he had 3 miles of gill webbing, which is a type of net that is a pretty frail kind of net, but it's made of nylon, and 3 miles is a bunch of it. And he would come home, I remember, as a boy, he would come home and he would have several number 3 wash tubs with those nets just thrown in them that he had taken up. And he would say, son, I need you to go clean up my nets. And we would go 3 miles, okay, picking these things out. And they had, you know what cuckoo burrs are? Huh? Yeah, you do? Well, when they get in a net, they're not easy to get out. and there were sticks in it. There were places in it where it had been torn. It had to be mended. Well, that's the idea that he's saying. You patiently sit down and you straighten this out. And you fix it so that it can be used again. Let me suggest three things, and this is not going to be a new sermon. I'm going to wrap it up, that we can do to accomplish the goal of helping those who are weak in areas of weakness. First, we can confess our own struggles and our own sin and not try to closet our own sins. We can help the weak to understand that we have weaknesses also. We're not perfect. We all depend on God's grace. How young do you think we are when we first start trying to cover our tracks on what we've done wrong? We say, it wasn't me, it was her, it was him. It starts pretty early in our life and we perfect it, don't we? I suppose most of us are strugglers that trying to pretend that we have it all together, closeting failures. Bitterly disappointed with ourselves, but talking as though things couldn't be better in our life. And so we need to confess our own weaknesses. And secondly, we can promote a closeness among members. It's much easier to open up to somebody that you believe cares about you than it is a total stranger. Who in the world can go up to a total stranger and start confessing weakness? Saying, I'm struggling with temptation to commit adultery. It doesn't happen, does it? You have to believe that someone cares about you. You have to believe that someone has your interest at heart and that they have a desire, a genuine desire to help you. We need to develop a closeness as a body so that we can comfortably share with each other our struggles, our temptations, our weaknesses, and gain strength from one another. And then finally, we need to be careful in our teaching as we condemn sin by letting the sinner know that he's not the enemy. Sin is the enemy. When the prodigal son came home in Luke 15, he was met by two people. You know where I'm going, don't you? Two people, a father and a brother. And the brother wanted to pull the covers off of his younger brother. He wanted to talk about how terrible he was and all the things that he had done and how horrible they were. And how damaging and how much hurt he had caused the family. And the father just simply wanted to say, my son, that I was afraid was dead, is alive. Sin tried to destroy him, but he's come back home. And that is an attitude that you can confess your weaknesses to and pray together to God that he'll make us stronger. Tonight, if there's something that you're really struggling with in your life and you need the prayers of brothers and sisters, you have a family, God's family, that cares about you. And we want to pray together. And if it's a time to cry, then we want to cry together and hold one another. Because I need you, and maybe you need me, and we all need God. Won't you come while we stand and sing?